This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Emergency Fund, has just released a disturbing new report about the dangers facing children in the refugee crisis impacting the Middle East and Europe. The report is entitled Danger Every Step of the Way, a Harrowing Journey to Europe for Refugee and Migrant Children. It details how the most vulnerable refugees, children, face abuse, exploitation, rape, and death. Shockingly, more than 90% of children arriving in Europe this year were unaccompanied minors. Most of the refugees risk their lives traveling from Somalia, Nigeria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and other countries to Libya, whose port, a capital, Tripoli, lies on the Mediterranean coast. They pay smugglers to board risky boats and rafts and head to various European coastal nations, such as Italy. My guest is Sarah Crowe. She's a spokesperson for the Refugee and Migrant Crisis with UNICEF. She joins us now from Geneva. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this figure of 90% of children arriving in Europe this year being unaccompanied was really shocking. And does that basically mean that these are children under the age of 18? And why are they unaccompanied?
Well, it is an alarming figure, as you say. And the testimony that young people have told us, have given UNICEF, of their journey is an arduous and terrifying journey, particularly when they get to the central Mediterranean. But not only that, at every single step of the way, and countries of origin, where they come from, and how smugglers and traffickers are exploiting these children on their journeys. This route has been a traditional route for many unaccompanied in the past, but we haven't seen these kinds of figures on the central Mediterranean route. So in the past year and a half, 2015 into the beginning of 2016, what we saw was the eastern Mediterranean being used by Syrians, Iraqis, Afghans. And that closed down effectively, although there are still some who are trying through various means to get through the Balkans, to get through Greece and so on. This happened as a result of the EU-Turkey agreement that effectively closed down that route. The route that is being used by sub-Saharan Africans, and indeed now even Egyptians, is the central Mediterranean, and it is the deadliest route. You know, nearly 3,000 people have died on that crossing. And when it comes to children, it's very possible that even more numbers that we just don't know, because they're not always registered, the numbers of children who drown and on that crossing. So it's an alarming figure and really a kind of a wake-up call for child protection systems to be improved across Europe.
I want to play a video that UNICEF provided of one refugee just describing the dangers that face migrants.
Journey is so hard, you know. The journey is so hard, but we thank God, you know, when there is life, there is hope. You know, it's a dangerous, it's a journey of death. You understand? You take it from deserts. You understand? You take it on desert to Tripoli. We just came to Tripoli to work, but you know, there they will treat you as an animal. Even we have one friend here, they just shot in hand, you understand? They beat you with calm, do whatever they want.
And that is the voice of one of the refugees that UNICEF has spoken to that describes the dangers of the journey. And he described, Sarah, the fact that many of these refugees, of course, first of all, have to take a very dangerous journey across land. When they arrive at a port city like Tripoli in Libya, then they embark on a sort of second extremely dangerous journey across the sea. Is it that standard sort of two-pronged journey that most refugees have to go through?
Exactly. And for many of them who are coming from even further afield, from Eritrea, from Somalia, and Sudan, it can take months and even years for them to cross this. It's the Sahara, it's desert, it's a very, very tough land crossing and an even tougher sea crossing. And they really are exploited at every step of the way. So, you know, our call is really that when they do get to Europe and even before that, they need to be protected at every step of the way. First of all, they need to be protected from smugglers and traffickers. What we're seeing with this crisis, it's effectively the first digital humanitarian crisis, if you like, where smugglers are also using online smartphones and so on to reach those who are the most vulnerable and exploit children. There's a system that is known as pay as you go. And they smugglers often go to families or to children themselves and say, give me some money, I will take you to Europe and get you work, get you refuge. And of course, that does not always happen. And their journeys are really very arduous. And once they reach Europe, it's another journey, a journey that then means they need to be protected. They need to come into an education system. They need to get support from a guardian that will assess their best interests to see, in fact, whether they might have family ties elsewhere in Europe. And then reunify those children, if they do have a family elsewhere in Europe, with their uncles, cousins, and so on. So it's a process, but it's not over when they reach Europe. It's just another level of a journey.
Yeah. Now, how are the children that UNICEF works with essentially unaccompanied? Is it that many of them have lost their parents to violence, or are parents being separated from their children by smugglers, or are parents voluntarily essentially realizing they might only have the money to send their children to safety, and so putting their children in the hands of smugglers and just praying that they arrive alive and unharmed?
It's probably all of what you're saying. In the case of one young woman from Nigeria, for instance, she was an orphan, 17 years old, and fleeing a forced marriage that her uncle and her family had tried to insist that she gets involved, this much older man. So in her case, she did not want to get involved in this with this relationship, in this marriage, and so she fled. There's also, prostitution rings that young women and even boys are smuggled into. So it's a really mixed bag, and it depends from one case to the next, which is why we say that each and every child deserves a full hearing to determine the best interest of that child and to engage with that young person in finding solutions and in supporting them on their journeys, and also once they arrive to seek asylum, because children do receive protection by law in Italy, but then there may be other reasons why they want to continue. So a determination of their best interests has to take place for each and every child to hear their individual case stories.
Now, in your report, Danger Every Step of the Way, you have a section entitled Voices of Children, which I think was just really important to kind of document what the children themselves are going through, what their stories are. It's heartbreaking to even read these stories. It's heartbreaking to consider what an unaccompanied child goes through. And, you know, we have it here in the United States. We have a migrant crisis from Central America where unaccompanied minors are coming across the border, and it's, you know, equally heartbreaking. So these children who have many varied stories, when they arrive in Europe, does it depend on which port they arrive in, what rights they have, and how is UNICEF fighting for their rights to be preserved? Or are governments kind of cooperating and understanding that children are the most vulnerable, they need to be taken care of regardless of the political situation?
Well, each and every state has the responsibility and obligation to take care of the children in their own countries. And that is the same for whether they're coming from sub-Saharan Africa and coming to Europe. So our message is that children en route should not be detained for their migration or refugee status simply for that reason. It's never a crime to seek refuge. So when they arrive in Europe, they should not be detained, nor should they be detained on the way to Europe. But we know that happens. We know it happens all too often. And sometimes there are excuses that there are no alternatives than to put children in detention. That should not happen. Mm-hmm. Alternatives need to be found. Those alternatives would include pairing them up with foster families, ensuring that they have a guardian to respect their legal case and to follow it through. And when they arrive in Europe, they really need to have the process to determine whether they get asylum should be speeded up to 90 days maximum. At the moment, it can go on for many months, even into years. Wow. So for children, that's an eternity. And we have to remember that, you know, whether it's a child of 5 or 17, that person is still a child and has rights as a child and needs to be treated first and foremost before the refugee status is determined. That person is a child under the age of 18 and has rights to basic services, to education, to health. And all those requirements that every single country, almost every single country in the world, has signed on to the Convention of the Rights of the Child, and that needs to be respected, and those children need to be protected.
Sarah, what sort of trauma can these children go through? I mean, how does one recover? Obviously, it depends on what they've suffered. If it's, you know, some kind of assault, it's just probably something you never really recover from. But even the journey, the harrowing journey, as the subtitle of your report uses that word, harrowing journey, that they go through from leaving their home countries and arriving in Europe, I can imagine that it might take a very long time to recover from that trauma. Do they have access to mental health services in Europe?
It really is a mixed bag. It depends where and when and what country and at what time. They are really very sad stories, but those stories don't just remain stories. They stay inside the hearts and minds of those young people and stay with them. And the scars are deep and sometimes they never heal. So the important thing, exactly as you say, is that those children go through a process of healing or psychosocial first aid, as we call it. And depending on where and when they come through, for instance, last year, those who are on the move from war zones in Syria and Iraq and conflict areas of Afghanistan, they'd seen war, they'd suffered tremendously. And then there's another level of suffering while they're en route. And indeed, then the huge adaptation that they have to make to the countries of destination. For instance, in Sweden, there are 36,000 unaccompanied children, mostly older boys, mostly from Afghanistan. And they've had to learn a new language, learn a new culture. So in the Nordic countries, in Sweden and Norway and other countries in the Northern Europe, they have a system of integration and getting them into schooling, getting them into language training, and trying to absorb them and integrate them into their new societies and their new homes. But it's slow and difficult. And so that's why we say it's another step of the journey once they reach their final destination. It's just level of adaptation that they have to make.
Are girl refugees more vulnerable than boys?
I think you can't necessarily say that that's the case, because we know that boys can just as easily be smuggled into prostitution, into yeah. gangs, into any form of modern enslavement, if you like.
Right, children are children.
The majority of unaccompanied are boys. In the case of those coming in through Italy this year, 95% of them are boys. But they too need their rights to be respected, and they have the right to be protected as well. But yes, girls, you could say, very often are more vulnerable. And that's probably why we do not see the numbers of girls, the same proportion of girls as we see of boys. And we know in many circumstances, in the case of Afghanistan, Iraq, for instance, that families do bandy together and say they'll send their oldest boy to give them a better life, to give them a chance at having a future, because their past has already been tainted, and they have seen far too much for their young years. So in those circumstances, they really are sent away by their parents to perhaps join a relative in Europe, or indeed with the hope that those children will be given asylum. So it's a very complex picture, and one that is fast changing and fast moving, and UNICEF has had to adapt its response accordingly for each country and for each individual situation. Just recently, the government of Italy called on UNICEF to provide help, training, to put in place various guidelines, to provide monitoring systems, and to really support the Italian government's efforts, as we are doing in Greece and in Germany. So we're not traditionally created for countries in Europe. It's more of countries that are in more dire need. But we have had to rise to the challenge of this crisis and adapt accordingly.
And finally, Sarah, what more can governments do? And I'm wondering if you can address the United States, because we're an American program and our audience is primarily U.S. Residents. What can governments do to support the work that UNICEF is doing? Is UNICEF's work fully funded? I'm sure you can always use more.
Yes, indeed. There's never too much when you have a crisis like this, and a crisis that is quite unpredictable and quite difficult to see where it's going. It's not like a flood or an earthquake where you can actually see the effects of it. This is slow moving. We know that the drivers of migration will, if they are not addressed, and that means poverty, war, conflict, instability, insecurity, if those drivers that push children and young people away from their homes, nobody would want to leave their homes, if those drivers are not addressed, then this will become a never-ending saga. So the most important thing is really to support the countries of origin and the families where the children are, the countries where the children are coming from and their families, and to make sure that children get into school, that they have a form of protection in their own home countries, first and foremost. That is really essential. And of course, in the longer term, to stop wars and conflict that will push people from their homes and force them to take these very dangerous journeys. But in the longer term, it's really when they are in countries, whether it is in the United States or Canada. We've seen Canada has been very, very gracious in opening its doors to refugees and those in need. And wherever they are, we have a hashtag called Act of Humanity, an initiative that welcomes in refugees and to really reach out to communities to help communities help refugees and to consider them to be children first and foremost. That's the main message, and really to support their integration, because this is really critical. If they're not integrated soon and quickly and rapidly into their new societies, children can fall into delinquency and at best. And at worst, all kinds of other things where they really feel marginalized in society. Right. So it's in the best interest of the child, but also in the best interest of those communities where they've settled.
Well, Sarah, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us. And I really appreciate you talking about the root causes. And we know, of course, that the United States bears a huge responsibility when it comes to being a driver of war in the region. And so we Americans bear a huge burden. Sarah, thank you so much for all you do and for joining us today.
It is indeed global. So that's really the bottom line. Thank you very much.
Sarah Crowe is a spokesperson for the Refugee and Migrant Crisis with UNICEF. You can find out more about the report at unicef.org. Or check our website at risingupwithsonali.com for a link. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.